Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. Before they were legends of outlaw country, they were lost souls looking for their sound. Don't miss Mandy Moore and the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Hear how one woman's vision and her tiny living room, far from Nashville's Music Row, became the epicenter of a musical movement. Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in The Boar's Nest. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest.
Pushkin. When Esperanza Spalding won Best New Artist at the Grammys in 2011, she made headlines for two reasons. One, she was the first ever jazz musician to win the award. And two, she stole Best New Artist from Justin Bieber. The Beliebers are still pissed. Since that first big win, Esperanza has won three more Grammys and released seven studio albums, including 2017's Exposure, which was conceived, written, and recorded entirely in 77 hours on Facebook Live. In 2018, she released 12 Little Spells. It was inspired by the Japanese healing art Reiki, with each song composed as a spell for a specific part of the body. Looking at her body of work and how she's evolved from a young, prodigious stand-up bass player and jazz composer to an experimental, multimedia, conceptual artist, it's easy to see why Esperanza Spalding sees herself as more than a jazz musician. But her improvisational approach to turning abstract ideas into emotionally moving pieces of music pretty much makes her the personification of jazz, whether she likes it or not. This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond. Esperanza sat with Bruce Hedlund in Brooklyn to talk about the instinctual way she makes music, jamming with Joni Mitchell, and the opera she's writing with the legendary Wayne Shorter that's set to be released next year.
Wow, this place is really beautiful.
It's a nice studio.
It's got a good vibe and it's huge. This is actually reminding me how much I love to be in the studio. It's been about a year, and I think that means it's time to go back soon.
You haven't been in a studio in a year?
Mm-hmm.
And was for that, that was for 12 little spells?
It was for the four bonus spells. It's actually 16 little spells now because...
Okay.
Because of some of the finagling that one must do when you're dancing through the music industry.
you wanted 16 originally, but they don't.
No, I wanted 12.
Okay.
And for there to be a second wave and reason to talk about the project again, I was asked and encouraged to write for more songs. Because apparently I've yet to grow into the awareness of what it is to generate music as commodity.
Mm-hmm.
My first instinct is always to figure out a way to just release it big and around and wide.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to release the 12 little spells, one every day at 12:12, leading up to my birthday. And I wanted to just blast them out because I wanted the effect of the spells to reach as many people as possible.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard to capitalize on that approach.
Mm-hmm.
So in collaboration with the label, we came up with the idea of, well, let's make four more bonus spells, and then there's a reason to go get the record. So,
Now, we should explain, okay. 12 Little Spells, which was your last full album, was, they were 12 songs, now 16, but they were based on different parts of the body.
Correct.
Did the concept come first for that, or did the songs come first?
It came as a hit, almost like an instruction manual. I can remember I was in transit. I don't remember from where to where, but I know that by the time I got home to my apartment, I had written out the outline of the whole project, that it was 12 little spells and the title, and what the title was saying, which was an announcement of what this work is as an interim piece before the next big project. Mm-hmm. So the title's 12 little spells to tide you over till the next full thing. Touch in mine. The longing deep down you have to dance. Now know, all limbs are readying to rise, dancing the animal with others. And it was it's a sort of poem explanation of what this project is until the next project, which is about dancing and movement and dancing that, the wild, untethered free forms of dance with structured presentation. So by the time I got home, here were the song titles. Here were their effects on the body, and I had my instruction manual. And then I spent a month and some change just assembling that structure, assembling that entity from the instruction manual.
So you wrote all that on the subway?
No, I wrote it all in a castle in Italy.
Okay.
But the download—
Your life is sounding better and better, yeah.
Yeah, that was amazing. That was amazing. Every morning I would be— go from where you pick up your espresso in the morning if you so desired. And they had me in the converted pig pen because I didn't want to be in the cast because I figured it would be extremely haunted. So I would go get my espresso and then walk around the periphery of the castle back towards my converted pig pen, which is in another, part of the grounds. And I would pass Azar Nafisi almost every day, who was working on her book. And just that process of witnessing, a master craftsman sitting and witnessing the development of their piece page by page, was the fuel, part of the fuel, I think, for making this happen. Because, the creative process is abstract. It feels sometimes like you're doing nothing. So it was so encouraging and affirming to witness another person in that practice accumulating that body that they came to work on.
Now, there's always the descriptions of you, you're a prodigy, you're this, you're that.
I would like to lean into the microphone now and dispel those myths that I was a prodigy or anything like that. I wasn't a prodigy. I have a talent in music, and I found my way early on. But I have seen prodigies, and I know prodigies, and it's a thing. It's like a subset of the species, And I partly want to dispel that myth because I think it's misleading. It makes it seem like maybe there's something special or something different fundamentally about, my makeup as an entity, as a humanoid. And it's not true. There are some folks who are, and they're exceedingly rare. And then there are other folks who just figured out a way to get a lot of practice in early on. And it accumulates, and then you can do things that other 10-year-olds can't do. But it's not necessarily because I was a prodigy. It's because I played a lot. I practiced a lot.
Well, is that good? Because prodigies, and being a prodigy often is it's maladaptive. They don't it's if you're great at something when you're five, often you're doing the same thing at 35, and people are, there's always those great classical musicians who are, who are described as the 50-year-old child prodigy, and they can't kind of get past what they did at a certain age.
Right. And the part that I resonate with about that quote-unquote prodigy part is simply the part where nobody can explain why you can do what you can do, And I think part of what sets a prodigy apart is that for the same amount of time that their friend in the music school puts in, this kid just gets more done somehow. They're just able to do more for reasons that nobody can explain.
Right.
And at a certain point when you want to expand past what it is you've become good at, but you don't remember why you can do what you do, that is intimidating and stressful. It can be. And I can appreciate why you wouldn't lean into that territory. And there are some aspects about, you know, my practice that it's like what I was saying before, the divination. There are some aspects that I don't know how that happens or how it works. But when I try to apply that to like a new medium, let's say like writing an opera, it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. then you discover like, okay, there's a process here. There's a skill set that must be developed to yield the same results over here as I'm able to yield over there without having necessarily mastered that skill set, you know? Mm-hmm. So just saying, I have compassion for the 50-year-old child prodigies out there. Mm-hmm.
What was your first experience of music then? What do you remember?
Well, it would be my mother singing in the house and making up little songs about whatever was happening in the moment. So she had this one, "You don't need to cry because your mama is by. Your mama who will love you and will never, never leave you. You don't need to cry because your mama is by." You know, I don't know where that comes from. But she would always have this sort of soundtrack happening to life. There was like a wake-up song. There was a prepping a meal song. And that is my first memory of music. My first memory of music out there was hearing your ma on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Like I've said that so many times in my life, but it was. And
hearing Yo-Yo Ma.
Hearing the Bach cello suite. I don't know if it was Yo-Yo Ma or it was the Bach cello suites, but either way, he was the vehicle. And
on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.
Wow. Which also, the interesting piece about that episode is after Yo-Yo Ma performed, they went to Make Believe Land. Mm-hmm. And in that episode, the next thing that happened is Lady Aberlin was dressed as an upright bass, and the other woman character was playing an upright bass. And I don't have a conscious memory of seeing that, but that again was like the download that all came at once. And then it's a humbling reckoning of like, oh, I'm just following the programming that I didn't even realize I received, you know, at five. So and
now, is that just a memory or on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood?
No, that actually happened.
Have you seen it since?
I only know that happened because I've seen it since. I don't have a conscious memory of seeing that in the episode. What I remember is hearing, I didn't know it was a Bach cello suite at the time. I can remember the prickling and the this almost like pain, you know, such a deep sensation of attraction to something that I felt towards the music that Yo-Yo Ma was playing. No conscious memory of seeing the basses. But later, when I saw the episode, I went, oh, damn, I just followed the instructions, you know, that all came at the same time. Those are my first memories of music.
Well, you can do worse than follow Mr. Rogers.
Amen. I agree.
I think you did well.
I agree.
And then your first instrument was what?
Well, it would have been violin. Mm-hmm. They didn't have any half-size or quarter-size cellos at the program that I first entered music through. So it was fortunately or unfortunately violin. And that, yeah.
Unfortunately, you didn't like the violin?
I didn't really like the violin. I like other people playing the violin. But yeah. I was seeking that sound. I was seeking what I heard.
You wanted the cello.
I wanted the cello. And thank God. And then I just skipped past the cello and went right up
to the bass.
Next floor up to the bass.
Yeah. And then when did the bass start?
You know, I don't know if the bass has started yet. It's such immense territory. And for all the technical facility one can accumulate early on, it, again, serves a very profound function in music. And I think that the older one gets, the more one matures, the better they are at actually being a bass player. So I don't know if bass has begun, you know?
When you started playing, how much were you practicing?
I don't remember, really. Probably a lot. I don't remember those early days. I just remember playing by ear and suddenly hearing this music that I was told was jazz and having a very deep, again, visceral reaction to whatever they were doing, you know, having no understanding of what it was or how it worked. Yeah.
Are you still that kind of instinctual player? Or
yeah. I am.
Because this is what scares people about jazz. It's incredibly complicated. It seems like endless scales.
It is.
All that theory, do you know all that stuff?
No.
Even
I know
now?
Some, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. And it never ends. Because the I don't feel authorized to speak on behalf of the genre in any way, because I would say I'm a jazz singer when I need to be, and I can play bass for other jazz musicians. But the centerpiece, like the center of what it is I do, isn't really jazz because of that practice and devotion that is required.
You don't think you have it?
Not in that way. Not in that way. As an instrumentalist, which is fine. It's cool because I can still support the instrumentalists who are in that devotional practice.
But that's how you started. You were
absolutely.
You were known as a jazz bassist.
Absolutely.
You won Best New Artist, I think, Grammy
right.
for that.
Yeah. Right, right. Yeah. And still, I wonder what the parallel is in writing. It's like you can support... You can be a part of something without actually being a devotee of that craft.
Well, most writing is all. You mean writing music or writing?
I mean writing word.
So what do, you know, because if I go on YouTube, I see you playing with, you know, Herbie Hancock and Chick Corea.
Yeah.
What are you giving them then? There's got to be more technically.
Yeah.
Sophisticated players, or at least more theoretically sophisticated players than you. You're doing this by instinct. What do they get? When I ask you to come and play with me, what am I getting?
You're getting listening and light speed response and a dance floor for your dance. I'm giving you a moving dance floor. And I have studied some of the theory. Just to say, partially I like to re-articulate this because for any young aspiring instrumentalist listening, I want to make sure that I'm speaking that truth, that to be a quote-unquote jazz musician, like, don't listen to me, listen to Scott Colley or you know, Ben Williams or Christian McBride or Linda Oh or players who, if you want to have a cue into the expression of the jazz pedagogy, listen to those bass players. I'm doing something that's valuable and beautiful and works and supports, but it's not really coming from that kind of devotional space. It's very intuitive and very much in the presence, very much something that evolves in relationship with players, you know? So yes, I can play with Herbie, I can play with Chick, because I'm becoming what is needed in that moment with my technical facility to, you know, come as my voice, as my listening, as my voice. It's almost like an active listening with players like that.
So are they, because you're a band leader as well, when you're playing with players like that, are they kind of setting the tone and then you're responding? Is it more a call response with them?
Yeah, it's more like, well, with somebody like, you know, Herbie Hancock or Jerry Allen, they want to have the conversation that can only happen with you in the room. It's not like, okay, here are these 10 songs. You happen to be the one here. So, yeah, come get in on this and make this work for me. Especially with Herbie, especially with Jerry, it's more like, oh, who are you? What do we sound like together? And in that space, it might kind of be an advantage not be too tethered to a technical or historical or pedagogical approach to making the music, because then you're free to discover what's actually happening in real time, which might not sound like anything that player did before. It's going to have their characteristic. But that is my superpower, you know, of being present and going like, whoa, what is this actually right now? Let's make it, and it won't probably happen again. And that was that, you know.
Mm-hmm. Do you have to make eye contact with a player to do that? Do you have to see what he's doing?
Just here.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Could you do it blindfolded?
Yeah, of course.
Really?
Yeah, of course. I don't look at the instrument when I play.
No, I don't mean your instrument.
Oh.
I mean the combination of like if you're playing with, you know, Wayne Shorter here, yeah, and Herbie Hancock there.
Yeah, that's how much a great of that, day, you know, by the way.
What?
That's a great day. I wish that would happen more.
but you know, string quartets, the players kind of have to see each other. They have to see their cues.
Right.
I'm wondering how important is that in when you're playing in a jazz combo.
Ooh. Well, I'm thinking of Wayne Shorter's quartet. They are very much connected with each other, looking at each other, but I am positive they could do everything they do blindfolded,
mm-hmm,
because they're co-composing a scene, you know? It's like, I'm sure actors could have a perfectly potent and coherent improvised scene blindfolded, because you're responding to the reality of emotional response. You're responding to what comes at you, and eventually a momentum of the scene is generated, and that is propelling you forward as much as you're creating it as you go. You know, that mode of performance, co-composition, improvisation is like that.
Okay, next time you're with Herbie Hancock, I want you to blindfold yourself and see how it goes.
I would never ask him to do that, but I'll hold it in the space and see what happens if I don't look. I remember dancing tango a little bit when I was a teenager. And, you know, there's certain fundamentals that you learn, and it's an improvisational dance form, right? Obviously. When you're dancing with a phenomenal dancer, everything just kind of works, you know? And I remember that experience of being very inexperienced and getting on the dance floor and just being like, oh, damn, I can do it. I'm good. Shoot, I'm twisting and turning and kicking and all kinds of stuff. And then you go dance with the next partner and it's like, you know, it's like a fumble. Looks like a silverware drawer without a divider, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So there's also something to be said for the potency of the master, you know, that partially just by playing with somebody like that, the immensity of their musicianship and ability to make everything work kind of heightens your own capacity and shows what is possible.
We'll be back with more from Esperanza Spalding after the break. As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet, but you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Willie Nelson,
Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter The Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/theboar'snest.
We're back with more from Esperanza Spalding.
What's it like working with Wayne Shorter? You talked about his writing before.
Yeah.
What's it like playing with him?
We've actually only played a few times.
Mm-hmm.
And it felt like visiting another planet. It truly felt like we've been living on one musical planet your whole life, seeing different lands and territories and cities and towns and ruralities and municipalities. And then you step onto what you think is just another land, you know? Music starts, okay, here we are. And all of a sudden you recognize, like, no, all of this is different. All of this is extraterrestrial. All of this is expansive. Mm. All of this is just more and different and shaped like the Earth. And maybe the gravity is similar, but it's not. He is so incredibly adept at connecting seemingly disparate ideas in a room, in a conversation, and musically, that it's like, it feels like you have to start listening at light speed to be able to connect what just came over there with what's happening over there. That is nebulous. I apologize. It's hard to describe it, but...
Is it scary playing with someone like that?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, very much so. Yeah. And why is it scary? Why is it scary? What does scary mean in that context? Is it scary? It's scary in a sense of, oh, damn, can I hang? You know, can I help? Can I feel free? What is it of the most that I can bring into the space? Will it have a place? Will it work? You know? You know, it's like sitting at a table and a conversation's already happening and you're like, I don't know what anybody here is talking about, but I'm being asked to come and speak. So it's something about having the trust that your life is enough, that what you've lived endows you with insight and perspective and presence, and that the other people at the table actually want to talk with you. So it's not about, oh, I'm able to refer to the things that you all have studied and know. It's something about having the confidence that at any point in time, we can find like a common space to converse.
Do you always feel confident when you're playing with someone like that? You can find it. Do you ever feel nervous? Like, this guy's talking about something. I can't.
Sure.
Really?
Of course. Don't we all? I mean, hopefully that's how you know you're expanding. And having new tastes and new experiences.
Yeah.
You know, to not always feel equipped, like I'm going to come in and slay.
I don't mean that, but are there times you're playing with someone, I'm going to use Wayne Shorter, and you just feel like, man, I'm just disappointing here. I'm not contributing.
No, well, listening is contributing. I mean, that's so much of the gift of somebody who's so full, like a Wayne Shorter. Just hanging out with him at the house, I mean, Just listening becomes dialogue, you know, and becomes dynamic. 'Cause we need to be heard too, you know, for all that poetry and wisdom and philosophical playmaking that one can do. It's not fun when you're just by yourself in the house, right? I think he's really good at amusing himself, but yeah, that's a valuable. That's what I mean by being the moving dance floor. It is. It's valuable. It's valuable.
So a very different artist that you like, and I'd like to know more about her influence, is Joni Mitchell.
Oh, God.
Now, Joni Mitchell is interesting to me because she seems to have two audiences. Mm. Everybody knows Big Yellow Taxi mm-hmm. and Both Sides Now, and mm-hmm. and people love her and revere her for being part of a generation. But jazz people really mm-hmm. like her. What is it you're hearing in her? What inspires you?
I mean, jazz people like creative, seeking music, you know, in general. All the jazz people that I know don't just listen to jazz music. Mm-hmm. They listen to music that seems to be reaching and finding new combinations of the sounds that we're all working with out here, essentially.
So what is it about her music that, what are you hearing there?
I think if I actually try to articulate it, it's going to be a lie. Because beyond the obvious that points that we all are drawn to, like the poetic imagery and the unexpected way that she illuminates a scene and brings us into a place and a space and an emotional understanding of a person or a relationship. There's just there's something magical and magnetic, which doesn't tell you anything. But where I feel the draw, I can't honestly articulate. I think part of it is the attraction to somebody showing possibility that's so far beyond anything that's been revealed in that genre or mode of playing before, you know, as a quote-unquote folk musician or as a poet or as a lyricist. It's like, you know, watching I can't explain it.
Mm-hmm. I should say when I even said her name, you sort of put your hand up to your heart like you were slightly stricken.
And that's the mystery. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the mystery.
You can hear strands of the sort of thing she does in, I think, particularly the Emily album.
Okay, cool. That's when I discovered her music.
Oh, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever met her?
Yeah, for sure. I jammed at her house a few times.
Okay.
This year, last year.
You're telling that story now.
I very surreal experience. Actually,
but back up. Tell us that story. How you ended up there? Who was there?
Well, the first time that I went to her house, because I had to back up a step further.
Okay.
Last year, I moved to LA for 7 months to be near Wayne and to be on the ground moving forward the development of this opera, because mm-hmm. I felt like it had gotten stagnant somehow, you know, just the logistics of workshopping it and getting it off of the page and out of the speculative into the real. And I thought I need to just go there. You know, Wayne was having some really intense health issues, and I wanted him to feel like this thing is really happening. Like, we're doing this. So that turned into some very inventive approaches to making workshops happen, orchestral workshops happen, scene workshops happen, at a time when he couldn't physically write. He was suffering from a metabolic tremor. And so we had to figure out a way to get what he had written up into an orchestra. And I thought that the most invigorating thing for him would be to actually feel coming back at him what he had written, so that it would feel like an opera's really happening here. So we're doing those every week, every 2 weeks. And at some point it came up, well, gosh, Joni Mitchell heard that you're doing this and wishes that she could see it, but, you know, it's hard for her to leave the house, blah, blah, blah. And I don't know whose idea it was. I feel like it was her assistant. I was like, why don't we have the rehearsal at Joni's house? So we did. We took
a... And now, does she have a formal role in the opera, or is she...
No, just... And I mean, she wanted to hear what Wynn was working on and thought it was cool. So she opened her home to us. So we brought a piano player and about five singers and a small little orchestra, probably eight players. And we crammed into her music room, and she sat next to Wayne, and I sat next to Wayne, and Frank Gehry, who's working on the set, who will be making the sets, also came over. And it was just a surreal moment in time that I actually forgot about until you just said it, because it was so surreal. It didn't seem like a part of this plane, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because those are two of my favorite creators of all time, you know? And yeah, a lot can be said about the moment. Partially it was surreal because I was so dissatisfied with the libretto at that particular moment. I was just cringing that, like, the master of words was there hearing my, like, unfinished words. It's so ridiculous. But yeah, I was biting my nails, you know, for sure the whole time.
And was that the first time you'd met her?
No, I met her a few times before, but it didn't stick, you know.
Yeah.
Because I was just drooling and, you know.
So this time.
Not forming sentences. I was still drooling and forming sentences, but she said she liked my life force suit, and that
is that the one you're wearing
that's
now?
That's one I'm wearing now, and
yeah,
that
says Life Force.
It says Life Force. It does, and that really lifted my spirits. Yeah.
Is that? Did you design that?
Of course. Yeah.
Okay.
I wanted to stay in touch with the focal point of my work. You know, I'm seeking ways to translate. I'm seeking ways to bring us into resonance with our unique and abundant life force energy. And I also wanted a break from worrying about what to wear at events or just in the street or anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that it was going to be a year of hard work, so I made a work suit for myself. I just said, let's go.
So that's all you wear?
Yeah, that's all I wear. Yeah.
How many of those do you have?
11, 12. You know, enough to
You're like a superhero. You just get in the costume every day.
That's the goal. That's the goal.
Be a superhero?
Yeah.
I
mean, my version of it. Be a super me, you know.
So what did Joni... I'm interested. What did Joni... I've never met Joni Mitchell.
Oh, you will.
I would love to.
Yeah.
We're both Canadian after all.
Uh-huh. Facts.
What did she say to you? What did when she heard what you were doing?
I don't remember. She said all kinds of things. It was out of body. It was out of body. But later, I did play some jam sessions, and I got to play bass for her, and I got to play an arrangement for her of The Wolf That Lives in Lindsay, and she dug that. So
was she singing when you were playing?
No, I just performed. Yeah, I played for her when she was singing.
Really?
It's like living room, like a session like this, you know. She invites over musicians, and we play the songs she wants to sing, and people play songs that she wants to hear or songs that they are working on.
Really?
And that they think she would like.
So you talked about playing with Herbie Hancock. What's it like playing with Joni Mitchell?
Well, it's the deepest listening you've ever done in your life. She's the deepest listening ever. Because it's not about like, oh, I'm going to play with Joni. I am listening for what she's doing in that moment and where her voice is going. And I want to offer the tones, the rhythms that make it feel good for her to sing at that moment, you know?
How did it go?
It was perfect. It was
wow.
Perfect. She sang Loverman and a couple other tunes.
The old song Loverman?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And she loves, you know, she loves jazz.
Old classics.
Mm-hmm. The jazz standards.
And
yeah.
She had trouble for a long time finding bass players. She always said bass players didn't understand her music.
Mm.
Because you did.
Mm. I don't know, but That's interesting.
It did okay?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
We'll be back with more of Bruce's conversation with Esperanza Spalding after a quick break.
As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet. But you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter the Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/theboarsnest.
We're back, but before we hear the rest of Bruce's interview with Esperanza, let's listen to a track off her album, Emily's De-Evolution, which we'll talk a bit more about in a second. First, here's the song, Change Us.
You said you weren't that, you weren't the prodigy, and you weren't, even now, you describe yourself as not, you don't feel like you're fully a part of the kind of jazz world. You're not.
But it's.
I was just going to say, you went to Berklee, which is like the MIT of jazz.
Oh, God, it's not. Bless its heart. It's an incredible convening space for anybody passionate about pursuing a career in music. It is. It truly, 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 truly is.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's like those terms, that nomenclature of what the music is, I think that the term refers to a very specific kind of devotion. So when I'm saying I'm not a quote-unquote jazz musician, it's just out of respect for that modality of devotion. Mm-hmm. I'm devoted to making and to creating, and that's its own thing. It's just, it's okay with me that I'm not, you know, an emissary of that devotional practice. Mm-hmm. And And I think it's something also about wanting to get out from under the signifier of being a jazz musician, because I feel like in some ways I used that, or it was used to promote me as a creator. And now, out of respect for what the devotional practice is, I want to make sure that we're clear about what's what, you know?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But
because you do a lot of different kinds of music.
Trying to.
I mean, re-listening to Emily, which mm-hmm. was your album before this one, I think.
Well, the album before this one, you can't get.
Oh, it was the Facebook album.
Because it was exposure.
I want to ask you about that.
Yeah.
But Emily was like a really, that was a really heavy, mm-hmm. I wish our co-host Rick Rubin was here, because he's an old heavy metal guy. He mm-hmm. would like guitar solos. Mm-hmm. What were you listening to when you did that album?
Damn. I was listening to, a lot of David Bowie, a lot of Jimi Hendrix, Cream, not a lot of Cream, but listening to Cream a little bit. I had seen a documentary about Ginger Baker.
And you worked with Tony Visconti, who produced a lot of Bowie, a lot of T-Rex.
Yeah.
It's got a lot of that
good
vibe in it.
Yeah. And it's like, sonically, the world that Emily needed to do what she came to do had those elements that you described. It was loud, and it generated movement, and it was about a power trio, and it was about an expression of power and breaking out of whatever had been practiced and whatever had become familiar, whatever had become fixed identity. So that's what Emily needed to burst into existence.
And Emily was a real character that you...
It's the lava of myself. It was the middle character of me.
But it was also, maybe more than your other work, about the songs themselves.
True.
You've written a lot of songs, but
true.
We tend to think of jazz as kind of a flow.
True.
And this was more like a song like Change Us.
Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, that's right.
There's no reason that wouldn't be a top 40 hit.
I know, that's right.
Did you want it to be a top 40 hit?
I mean, I didn't want it to not be a top 40 hit, but that hasn't, I mean, damn. I asked Emily what she wanted to do, and those were the songs that came out. And I didn't ask too many questions, you know? There wasn't a lot of, like, well, what should the influences be in this? Like, what do we want to happen with this song? It was just like, here's the instruction manual from Emily. Let's build it and see what we get. And we'll mm-hmm. morph it from there.
You like the instruction manuals.
I do like the instruction manuals. I trust that.
Because you also did an album where you said it was on Facebook Live. We're going to do it in 77 hours.
Yeah.
And you did the whole thing.
Yeah.
And everybody could watch.
Well, that offering, that performance was the performance of the act of creation. So how do you make an album of creation? They make an album of the creation process. That was a way that we figured out that we could capture or share my favorite part of making things, which is that moment where you get the hit, you think of the thing, and then you forge it. That process of forging it into the thing was the focal point of that project. As an act of improvisation, actually. It's like, I quote Wayne a lot. One of my favorite quotes is, he says, composition is improvisation slowed down, and improvisation is composition sped up. Mm-hmm. And that's what that project was.
Have you gone back to watch that after you've done it?
No, thank you. No.
No, thank you.
I'll never do that again. No, I haven't.
Why not?
Well, it already happened, you know? It's like, it was a thing that was alive in a moment. It's like a kiss or a dance on a bridge that you didn't expect with a stranger. It happened. And the magic of it was that it was happening in real time, and that it wasn't going to happen again. And that everybody with us was with us in that moment at that particular spot on the continuum of eternity. So, yeah, I don't have any need to go back and look at it.
Hmm. What I compare it to when I was watching clips of it was Let It Be, which is that's what the Beatles tried to do. They tried to show people how they were making an album.
Oh, cool.
That's why I'm wondering if you'd sort of learned something about how you made music if you did that.
Well, part of the, I guess, impetus for opening up that process was to share the kind of the ugly moments and the scary moments and the risk and the the imperfections that go into making anything beautiful. So to let it be seen that most of the process of making the song was working with something that didn't really work, but you can hear how a seed of that then led to what it became. And I felt like that was something worth sharing in a moment where so much of what we interface with is polished and complete and kind of seems like it just like dropped down glistening from the heavens. I was excited to share who I actually am, who we all actually are as creators. That's most of who we are. The majority of what makes us performers and artists and creators is that process. The finished thing is only like the last 100th of the whole being, you know?
But most artists, they want to protect that other 99. They don't want that out.
Exactly.
That's the ugly part. So why do you want that out?
I like that part. I wanted to celebrate that part. And, you know, that's my element also. The same way that performers get on stage and show their best stuff, they show like the best that they have to give. To me creating is my best stuff. That's why I wanted to share that as the performance, you know?
Which is kind of a jazz idea. I mean,
probably
more than pop.
Maybe so.
When did the singing start for you?
I'm, you know what I was just thinking? I was like, does that really matter? I mean, probably 8 or 9 or 10. But I feel like maybe we could talk about, I don't know, what's brewing now. I mean, singing started when I was out in the world, probably 15. And I feel like this particular moment in my life as a creator, I'm less interested in like the origin, and I'm more interested in now as an origin point, you know?
Okay, well, let me reframe it. I'm interested in what's happened because I went back and read some early reviews and they'd say, oh, her slender voice as she sings along. And then you listen to these albums and you're like, no, that's like a powerhouse.
Okay. I don't really think about my voice. I have to confess. I practice, you know. I try to sing to build. I studied to build capacity and different timbres and all that, but
do you sing to compose?
I do sing to compose.
So you're working on this opera.
Oh my God. Yes. Thank you. The segue.
Are you singing those parts?
I will sing in some capacity in this opera.
No, I don't mean in the final.
I don't mean in the final product.
Okay. I mean, when you're working on it, are you singing in your head? Are you singing out loud?
Sometimes. This process of making an opera is upside down and inside out from how operas are usually made because it took me so long to get the libretto written that Wayne already wrote all the music. So now we're reckoning with this incredible body of work, which is the music that he wrote sort of in these three acts already, and drawing story and language out from that. So in that case, sometimes I sing, but I'm actually trying to hear what an operatic voice would do with some of these lines. And there's a lot of speaking because some of the passages, the music functions as the environment and they're having a conversation, recitative, it's called.
Sure.
Or sometimes just spoken through. Thinking about or further unpackaging that invitation to write what you wish for.
Mm-hmm.
The opera seeks to interrupt the repetition of the same story being played out, that's played out in this original myth. And I'm looking for a way that as a writer, I can even interrupt the way that the endings are usually created.
Hmm. What's the myth? Is it a common myth?
It's the myth of Iphigenia. So she's the one who gets her throat slit. Well, she's sacrificed so that the winds will return and that Agamemnon and his brother and the fleet they've assembled to go recapture Helen can sail across the ocean to Troy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the story before the Trojan horse story that we all know.
Right.
This process of making the opera has unlocked a question about who gets to tell the story. Even me as a woman in the 21st century, and it's a time when voices that have often been in the background now get to come up and direct new narratives, new speculative narratives. We get to bring to the public arena our stories that have been silenced for so long.
Mm-hmm.
Even in this space, I'm asking the question, How do I break the cycle of the tyranny of the individual voice of the storyteller? And I wonder what becomes possible in the telling of this story when figures, people, characters who are often scripted into storytelling, mm-hmm. opera singers or musicians or actors, what becomes possible when their voice is activated in the actual design of the story, in the telling of the story. That is really, really challenging to do. It's beyond my capacity right now, but that's what we're reaching for.
Who's telling the story now?
Well, I am. I mean, and Euripides told it, and it's part of the Odyssey, and it was surely a myth that had been passed on for generations before it got written down. But I am really curious right now what happens when the ending isn't prescribed, and instead of barreling towards what we've been told must happen, we say no. What happens if we leave space for an unknown ending to emerge from us, I guess, co-creating in real time?
So that's the sort of, that is the jazz ethos, isn't it? We're going to substitute chords. We're going to change it.
Well, and all of those are just methods for approaching life in real time,
mm-hmm.
and improvising in response to what's actually happening. You know, it's not about like, oh, I'm going to change the chord because I'm a jazz musician. It's about, while I have access to enough material that I can respond to what's actually happening from a large batch of possibility. I'm not fixed by what I've practiced. I'm not fixed by what I've learned.
Mm-hmm.
It's supposed to happen next. Oh, that's it. Yeah. I am not limited to what I've learned is supposed to happen next. That's the key to how I want to break open the ending of this opera. Yes. Right. I'm glad we're talking about this.
That seems like a perfect place to stop.
Yeah.
Yeah, amazing. All right, well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks to Esperanza Spalding for taking time away from cracking the story structure of our upcoming opera to talk with Bruce. You can hear all of our favorite Esperanza Spalding songs by checking out the playlist for this episode at brokenrecordpodcast.com. Broken Record is produced with help from Jason Gambrell, Mia Lobel, and Leah Rose for Pushkin Industries. Our theme music's by Kenny Beats. I'm Justin Richmond. Thanks for listening.
Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? a room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
Musora is your access to online music lessons for guitar, piano, drums, and singing. This is your chance to reignite some old musical passions or pick up an instrument for the first time. Connect with more than 100 of the world's best teachers and musicians. You'll get 7 days totally free to try it out. And then it's just $30 a month, less than a single private lesson. I mean, why do we do Broken Record? Not just because we love hearing from great musicians. We do it because we think that there is something beautiful about the appreciation of music. Don't you think we need more of that in our lives these days? That's the mission of Musora, to inspire, educate, and connect musicians. Enjoy unlimited personal support, weekly live streams, student lesson plans. It's like having a personal music teacher, only much, much better. Just go to musora.com, M-U-S-O-R-A.com, to start a new musical journey today.